Poetic Justice Dialogue Series. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Parag Khanna. Parag is a leading global strategist and best-selling author. Born in India, Parag grew up in the United Arab Emirates, New York, and Germany. He became an accomplished adventurer, traveling to more than 100 countries and speaking 5 languages. He holds a PhD from the London School of Economics and has published 3 books based on his travels and unique research into geopolitics, geotechnology, and the future of international trends. Parag lectures frequently in international conferences and gives executive briefings to government leaders and major corporations on global trends. He is the director of the Hybrid Reality Institute, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and senior fellow at the Singapore Institute on International Affairs. In 2008, Parag was named one of Esquire's 75 most influential people of the 21st century. And I've personally been following Parag for a while and really find his voice quite unique and brilliant and refreshing on the international scene. So I'm quite honored to have him here this evening to be on my dialogue series and talk about his work. So welcome, Parag.
Thank you, hostess Vanessa. Really looking forward.
I'd love to start, open the conversation just by giving the listeners a bit of a feel for your own journey. If you just wanted to share maybe a little bit about your background, how you grew up, and some of the formative experiences that shaped the interest into the field that you got into.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I was born in India, and I've lived in quite a few places. United Arab Emirates in my childhood, and New York for kind of much of my adolescence, Germany for a big chunk of high school, and then back to New York, Geneva, London, Germany again. So kind of a wide range of places, and now over in Singapore. My father worked for Tata, the big Indian conglomerate, and they had sent to the Middle East. So we left India when I was very young, and my earliest memories are of the Middle East and then of the U.S. But I think I grew up in a pretty normal American type of suburban environment. But the big game changer for me, I call it, you know, my geopolitical awakening, was the same as it would be perhaps for anyone who's exactly around my age, and that was the fall of the Berlin Wall. And my parents immediately, sort of pulled my brother and me out of school, you know, within a month or two, and said, let's all take a family holiday to Berlin, and let's really live this moment. So much of the Berlin Wall still standing, and I sat on top of it. This was in the eighth grade, rented a little hammer and chisel and hacked away dozens and dozens of pieces and put them in Ziploc bags and brought them home for all my friends at school. And basically, I became a geopolitical junkie, you know, from that moment on. And I always just knew that that's all I ever wanted to do, is to travel, you know, travel, research, learn languages, work on diplomatic issues. So everything that I've done academically and, you know, most of my professional life has really been around the kinds of questions that relate to big geopolitical shifts, and, you know, not just studying historical ones, obviously, but chasing the current ones and anticipating the future ones. And that's basically what I do.
And you were on a diplomatic path, and then it shifted. I mean, it's still diplomatic, but it shifted its context.
Exactly. It's the diplomatic path that has shifted rather than me so much shifting. Because it really, I think I really grew up at exactly the point at which the notion that diplomacy really meant that you join the foreign service and, you know, work for your home government, and that government sends you somewhere and you stamp visas for a few years, then you go and analyze an economy for a few years, then you go and do the political section for a few years somewhere else. That was the strict definition of practicing diplomacy, you know. Yeah. And I really think that at precisely the time that I was even taking the Foreign Service exam myself and was seriously considering joining the U.S. State Department, that's when more and more people started to practice a whole different kind of diplomacy, in which working for an NGO, working, you know, in a corporate supply chain management role, you know, working in a movement, you know, for a major cause, environmental one or otherwise, all of these actually now are considered diplomatic in various ways. And diplomacy is your engagement in a global issue from some institutional perspective or the other, but it's not, strictly speaking, just representing your country and carrying a certain kind of passport. And I'm obviously very grateful that that has happened. Now that I've, you know, studied that historical pattern so closely, that became the subject of my PhD. Now I firmly believe that it's historically very well grounded, justified, legitimate, and appropriate and exciting that we enter this kind of postmodern diplomatic era in which really anyone can be a diplomat, depending on, you know, just sort of what you're doing rather than who you're doing it for.
Yeah, and I admit a bit of a personal interest, because I was actually seriously considering the diplomatic path. And it was when I came across your work, too, that I started to think a little differently. So I was really influenced by your ideas on all this, too. So anyway, so let's dive in a little bit to the questions. I wanted to focus mostly on your book, How to Run the World, Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance. But the ideas in that also really tie in with your the first book you did, The Second World, How Emerging Powers Are Redefining Global Competition in the 21st Century. So I was hoping, just for people who might not know of your work, if you could just kind of give a bit of a big picture meta context of how these two books kind of emerged and how the themes and ideas were tied in together and even informed each other and kind of had a certain evolution as you were writing.
Sure. You know, in the geopolitical field, the early 2000s were a period when people started to wonder what happens when American hegemony, you know, such as was so firmly entrenched at the end of the Cold War, what would replace that unipolar, you know, American-dominated world order? And so a very big literature began to emerge around the role of Europe as it coalesced into a 27-member European Union with a larger economy than the United States, with substantial commercial and other kinds of influence abroad. A growing literature started to look at China as well. There was a recognition that though it's not a superpower yet, you know, it certainly was on path to become one. And what I wanted to do was to reconcile these literatures in a way around geopolitical change, but to tell the story of that multipolar world from the standpoint of everyone else. So what I did over a 2 to 3 year period was to travel to about 50 countries. And I really did this kind of in a backpacking type of way. A lot of people say, hey, you must have all these frequent flyer miles. And I actually I only became the kind of, you know, Uber sort of a member of these frequent flyer clubs much, much later, because I did most of this travel on the ground. I mean, I basically drove around the world in big chunks, you know, taking 6 or 7 months at a time. And so, you know, it was obviously an amazing life-altering kind of experience. You know, I picked very important, interesting, quirky countries that are very significant in their own way, that's underappreciated, you know, whether it's Turkey or Brazil or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan or Malaysia or Libya, you know, a lot, or Ukraine. I mean, just dozens of countries that pop up only every now and then. And I tried to combine them into a coherent narrative of how, if you want to know who's going to dominate the future, go to these places and see which of the superpowers is doing the best job of winning friends and influencing people, you know, to borrow the title of Dale Carnegie's famous book. And that's really what the book was about. So it was my opportunity to just really stay very close to the ground in a very slow and steady way.
And these you called the second world, right?
Yeah,
these countries.
Yeah. Sort of second world countries. Right. And, you know, I was purposely reinterpreting a term that used to apply to the former socialist republics of the Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc countries. And that term fell completely out of usage by the mid-1990s. But I also chose it because it was not just an ideological term, but a socioeconomic one. And I wanted to argue that, in fact, a lot of these countries were not just geopolitically significant, but were socioeconomically very revealing, because rather than be middle-class countries, they were places where you could see that first-world and third-world conditions coexist in so many countries, and that is almost an irreparable kind of condition. And sure enough, today, around the time that I was writing that book, it became apparent that because urbanization and globalization together, you had wealth disparities growing within countries faster than across them. And so I actually tried to tease out those internal dynamics and tensions a lot in the book. So that's why I call it a work of geopolitical psychoanalysis. Right. It wasn't just this sort of balance of power theory applied to the 21st century, but done as a travelogue. I think that would have been very conventional. I really want to get in kind of under the skin of each country. And my quote-unquote methodology, I mean, I literally would not leave a country until I really felt like there was just no more value added for my research, where no one else who I would meet would be contradicting the things that I was thinking of saying about the country. So not that it was getting, you know, boring per se, but I felt like I got it, you know. Mm-hmm. and I really had to click with a country before I would leave or get chased out, you know.
But, did that happen?
Well, I wouldn't say chased out, but some places really do alienate you, yeah. And it's not necessarily always the places you think. I mean, you know, Libya under Gaddafi, you know, despite the heinous and horrific government, was, you know, actually a very safe country. Obviously, dictatorships actually tend to be quite safe for tourists. You know, even North Korea is very safe for tourists. But yeah. Libya was a lovely and charming place. Venezuela, at the time when people used to glorify Hugo Chavez, actually bought the mythologies of his Bolivarian leftist revolution, was just a disaster and continues to be an even worse disaster by day. You know, you couldn't leave Venezuela fast enough, you know, and it's just a horrible, horrible place.
Fascinating.
So, you know, everyone has their own impressions and experiences. I spent a long time driving across Russia, driving across China. You know, I could have spent an eternity in Western China, in the Turkic province of Xinjiang, just exploring the kind of old Silk Road connections there. So basically not a day goes by today where I don't see something in the news that conforms to a kind of a hunch or a hypothesis or an observation that I had back then about the trajectory of each of these countries. And so it was just the best education, obviously, that, you know, very little money was required, fortunately, to buy. And then, you know, if we move on to how to run the world, we were talking about diplomacy earlier, which is obviously a subject of great personal interest. And I did my PhD on the subject of the evolution of diplomacy. And, and that book was actually the sort of pop version of my dissertation. And the reason I gave it that ambitious title is because I really wanted diplomacy at the center of how we think of the construction of world order. We tend to think that, well, you know, America is the superpower, America makes the rules, and that's what world order looks like, and that's it. Yeah. And there's agency is basically accorded just to whoever has the power. And I think that diplomacy is then marginalized. And I wanted to talk about diplomacy as a process. It's the process by which we run the world. So actually, it's a very literal title. It's not meant to be, you know, headline grabbing. It was actually meant to be extremely literal, because running, that is what diplomacy is literally the practice, the management of world affairs.
Right.
And I wanted to put diplomacy in the center of everyone's mind, you know, something that isn't just boring, that isn't, you know, sort of poets and philosophers drinking wine and pontificating.
Right.
You know, I wanted to make diplomacy serious, but I also, as we discussed earlier, wanted to broaden the scope of participants in diplomacy to reflect the new realities.
Yeah.
So that was the purpose of that book.
Yeah, and definitely like the second world, like your first book really showed how we're moving into this multipolar, multi-powered world. And the second book really, How to Run the World, is really looking at how we can start to skillfully engage all the actors, both state and non-state actors, in that. You gave an interesting analogy in How to Run the World of, you're basically arguing that our global context is similar to what was happening in the Middle Ages, which I thought was a really unique framing. And then you also sort of redefine or give a different picture of a way to understand diplomacy within that context. And you call it mega diplomacy, right? Instead of just diplomacy.
Yes. Yeah, so the two sort of like, you know, animating arguments, if you will, you know, the first is that we are in this neo-medieval context and that the structure of the world is quite resembling the Middle Ages in two ways. The first is that it is multipolar and multi-civilizational. And if you think back 1,000 years ago, it was a time when Korean kingdoms, Indian and Chinese dynasties, the Arab caliphates, you know, were all very powerful. You know, it was Europe that was weak and divided. And so the Middle Ages has a very negative connotation in Western, you know, historical literature. But in fact, it was exactly the time period that many other civilizations think of as the Golden Age. Certainly Islam, that's the case. And of course, you know, if you think of Song Dynasty, China, and so forth. So I wanted to highlight that we live at a time when all regions are powerful and rising at the same time, and we haven't seen that in 1,000 years. So that was the first part of the argument. The second was that was also a multi-actor sort of context. That was a time when religious groups and corporations and diasporas, universities, and so forth were all prominent diplomatic players. That was the age of the city-state as well as the merchant class. And today we also see, of course, that diplomacy is populated by mayors, you know, and by CEOs and so forth. very much, and that they are very influential in diplomacy. So those are the two parts, or the two reasons why I argue for this neo-medievalism. So the second part is more descriptive and constructive, and that's the mega-diplomacy. And that part of the book is really saying that we need to think of diplomacy, again, not just as what diplomats from governments do with the United Nations. We need to think of problem-solving always requiring the cooperation of different groups, whether it's public sector, private sector, civil society, universities, religious groups. I like to call it the .gov, .com, .org, and .god, G-O-D, Those stakeholders are inevitably play a role in almost every global issue today. And yet we don't have frameworks. We don't have organizations. We don't have a United Nations for everyone. We have a United Nations for every official diplomat of 198 countries. But those may be legally representative of the world's population, but we know very well that they're not actually de facto representative of the world's populations and interest groups and so forth. You know, whether it is indigenous peoples of the Arctic Circle, or whether it's marginalized women's labor unions in India, whatever the case may be, actually a lot of people don't feel represented by the current diplomatic architectures. I was setting out to just kind of lay out the principles and some of the best practices that you can see today of that emerging architecture. And so that book is just packed with examples that, again, you can pick up the newspaper every day and you'll see something that more or less conforms to the idea. Well, here's one. I mean, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, an NGO, right, has just won the Nobel Prize. But of course, it's sort of an NGO that is funded by a wide range of groups, including governments, right? So you have this multi-stakeholderism. Yeah. Some people have said that book was sort of against the state or against the nation state or whatever, but I think that's pretty simplistic because I'm always emphasizing that it's not either or. It's not the state is gone and companies take over. I mean, other people have written that argument, and I think that's completely wrong. I call it mega diplomacy for a reason. It's everyone, it's governments and everyone else. So it's not a substitutive argument, it's an additive argument. And it's very chaotic, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's a complex landscape, but I believe in embracing that complexity.
Well, I wanted to read a quote from the intro of your book because I think it pulls back on what we've been saying and sort of leads into the next question. I do want to talk a little bit about some examples. The quote from the book is, "In international relations, there is no such thing as democracy. What we have today is a worldwide, perpetual, no-holds-barred contest for power and legitimacy between regimes, companies, NGOs, religious groups, and super-empowered individuals, all pursuing their own interests. From economic nationalists to resource-hungry companies to fundamentalists, everyone is out for themselves. Interest groups are not a marginal sideshow to some real politics, they are the politics. The best term for this scenario would be mosh pit." So I love that quote. And one of the things you say within that, the context of that quote, is that, one of the biggest sort of illusions we have to push past is this idea that there's any sort of silver bullet solution to these kind of complex forces at play. And I was wondering if you, obviously, like, there's organizations like the United Nations that are attempting to, address these multi-powers and multipolar issues. What do you see as, what is the silver bullet solutions you're seeing trying to be enacted that aren't working, and what would be the alternative if that's not going to be, is there going to be anything like a global governance? Is that even possible? And what would that look like?
I'm glad that you tacked on that last part of the question. You say, is there anything like a global governance? Because this is actually a book about global governance, but my editors never really let me use the term because they think it puts everyone straight to sleep. It does. But since you mentioned it, within this field of global governance, there's actually kind of been a transition towards what is called global policy. Global governance connotes some kind of fixed architecture or end state. This global policy is kind of open-ended. We are constantly making policy. We're constantly initiating new groups or collectives of actors to try and deal with problems, like new coalitions are popping up all the time. I sort of use approvingly that phrase from Donald Rumsfeld, coalitions of the willing, but I obviously use it in a very different way than what he had in mind. So in other words, global governance is there. It's just in a constant process of evolution. And I believe that you have to rethink these things in terms of, you don't assume that just because the United Nations is talking about peace and security in Sudan, or because the World Trade Organization is trying to reduce tariffs, that those don't represent fully the issues that you're actually talking about. So when you're trying to figure out how to alleviate poverty, you don't say, oh, well, we have to go to the World Bank because, well, it's called the World Bank, right? The truth is that the World Bank represents a really, really small fraction of money that flows between rich countries and poor countries. And the truth is that the World Trade Organization hasn't had a new round of negotiations in 10 years. And yet world trade continues, right? When you think, well, how do I cure polio or the next scourge or malaria, for example, you don't say, well, the World Health Organization is just going to do it for me. The truth is that half the budget of the World Health Organization comes from the Gates Foundation, right? So it's one of the examples I give in the book. Private philanthropic group underwrites a huge chunk of the budget of an intergovernmental body. And that's an example of mega diplomacy right there. And there's lots and lots of those. So it is, again, very chaotic. It is a mosh pit. And I think, again, let's just take climate change. You're going to do more for climate change through greening of supply chains, like what Walmart does and some paper companies do and some energy companies do, than by going to negotiations at Bali or Copenhagen or Cancun and all of these other exotic places where thousands of diplomats burn all their greenhouse gas emissions flying to cut down lots of trees and print lots of paper, because that's actually what's been going on in all these negotiations. They haven't achieved anything. So, I'm a big believer that technology and the spread of knowledge will do a lot more to address these issues. Microcredit did not come from the United Nations, right? It's something that we've seen emerge from the practice of doing it, whether it's, the Grameen Foundation in Bangladesh or other examples. So, and it was a scientific community that pushed for climate change in the Club of Rome. That was not something that the United Nations sort of said, we're going to take the lead and solve this issue. So we have to really bear in mind, what are the actual sources of authority and legitimacy? And it's much broader than just the governments that we entrust with the responsibility of negotiating these issues. So, that one of the messages of the book, of course, is that everyone should find their own way to be a diplomat, to engage, because, it's a roundabout way of saying something that people find cliche, but that is that everyone kind of can make a difference. And my way of putting it is that everyone is a diplomat.
Right. And do you think that the solutions to, it seems that conflicts that are happening in different areas and different issues, do you think they're going to be more context-oriented, like people working on a particular context issue rather than these big organizations trying to come in and manage all the problems?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does. I have some very scathing critiques of UN agencies and of, high-level commissions for this and that in the book. I like to think it's quite humorous, because if you really compile all of the ridiculously kind of utopian schemes that have come out of these centralized authorities and bureaucracies that we think of as being smart, sober people, it's disgusting. It's pathetic. It's the most horrific waste of money. I make myself sound like a Republican the way I talk about it, because it is just so repugnant to me how mature people who are supposed to, kind of understand how the world works, once they're put in positions of authority, all they do is live by the dictum that power corrupts. Mm-hmm. And you find that, some of the smartest people, most respected people in the world just, sit in fancy offices and cook up these reports that talk about how if you want to, address women's issues in the world, well, you need a $5 billion fund for women. Mm-hmm. If you want to improve the global environment, let's have a global environment organization. And for every little thing, they say, infrastructure. We need a global infrastructure fund to build roads and whatnot everywhere. And these bad ideas literally go back to the 1950s. They're all so top-down. Mm-hmm. So the irony, perhaps, and I think it could have been more explicit in the book, is that, How to Run the World is not a top-down book. It's actually a bottom-up book. it's kind of saying a bottom-up diplomacy amongst peoples and various smaller collectives is a more legitimate diplomacy than the top-down diplomacy that has been running the world for centuries.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because you You talk a lot about how our maps are kind of outdated. You know, when we if we look at a map, like you're looking at a physical map, how the interactions that are happening between countries now are just not mapped on the maps we have. And obviously, if we turn this kind of on the internal and our views of the world, it's probably similar that our maps are sort of outdated. How we see the world, how we see, you know, the global picture. And I was curious if you were to give some ways that we could start to shift our ways of thinking about globalization. I was thinking, like, one example you give, obviously, is which you mentioned was how our views tend to be quite American-centric, you know, so there's an American vantage point that can sometimes color the way we think about globalization. To talk about some of that, or maybe other ways that you think we need to shift the ways that we think about this, because I mean, I think that's a start to even just beginning to engage the kind of, you know, chaotic and emergent nature of all this.
I think globalization is the right subject to really take on when you're asking this question, because how one views globalization depends quite drastically on where one sits. And it is really, it's I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the debate about the future of globalization right now is not only very polarized, but in many ways, the kind of fate of the world hangs in the balance in how we think about this. Now, there's a lot of people who believe that globalization can just sort of be switched off and will retrench because of the U.S. financial crisis, for example. But, you know, astoundingly to them, that didn't happen, right? I mean, you know, global trade is growing, cross-border investment is growing, the number of airlines, you know, crisscrossing the world is growing, the number of expatriates in the world is growing. Almost every single way you slice it, except for some very narrow measures of certain kinds of capital flows, you know, globalization is thriving like never in history. But you wouldn't know it if you were a Wall Street banker. Unless, of course, you were one who was, you know, fired from his job or sent to go live in an emerging market, in which case you would realize that, in fact, global markets are growing very rapidly. In order to be part of that globalization, you need to actually, you know, leave your seat and your comfort zone and appreciate what's happening everywhere else. So, you know, one of the big themes for me, partially in that book, much more in my next book, is really about the future of globalization and how, in fact, it's the globalization between all of the other regions in the world, such as between China and India and Africa and the Middle East and Latin America, that is now a huge driver of globalization today. You know, trade and investment between China and Africa has grown by 1,800% in the last 10 years. That's quadruple digits, right? That's not a typo. And of course, it's starting from a low base, but today it literally is equivalent to the total US relationship with Africa and the European one. So we are reaching this kind of global parity in a lot of ways that I find very, very exciting. So the fact is that there is this organic resilience to globalization that is not appreciated by those who believe that it's driven only by America or is a top-down process. So to me, actually, that gives me a lot of kind of hope actually for the future, because I think that's a much more, as I say, organic kind of globalization. It's one that's in the interest of all of those participating in it.
And you talk about, you have a chapter on Gen Y. You talk about how you feel that they're sort of naturally kind of moving into this way of thinking. Did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is something fundamental. The psychological phenomenon of thinking globally, of having a certain sense of global solidarity, global citizenship, growing up in a manner in which global issues are considered central rather than secondary, that is relatively new, right? That's the last sort of 50, 60 years. There have been events with global consequences. There has been global thought. There has been global philosophy. But we didn't even have the word globalization until about 50 years ago. We certainly didn't have this density of global interconnectivity, you know, ever before. Certainly not at the time of World War I. It wasn't even close. As you know, it's a common argument that the world was quote unquote globalized on the eve of World War I, and then it all fell apart. But literally no comparison between the degree of globalization 100 years ago and today. It's an utterly foolish argument, quite frankly, that all too many smart people make, because again, they take an incredibly Eurocentric view. I mean, because Britain and Germany traded with each other before they went to war, that doesn't really tell us a whole lot about the ways in which the entire rest of the planet now has built supply chains and oil pipelines crisscrossing and connecting with each other. So there is just an enormous density of volume of activity that characterizes this new globalization. I think young people are growing up with an inherent sort of awareness of that. That doesn't mean that they like it. You know, at no point am I saying that they like it. It is a natural condition in the same way that growing up with mobile phones is today a natural condition. But that doesn't mean that the hall has positive consequences. I mean, there is a huge degree of winners and losers. You could read one of my books or anyone else's books and come away with the view that I'm sort of, you know, one-sided and celebrating this. But I'm pretty clear, you know, about the winners and losers and in the way I go about this. And there's a lot of young people who are very frustrated and left out. You know, it is international capital flows and dynamics that have exacerbated the current Eurozone crisis that now has 40% of Spanish youth unemployed, right? So, you know, they aren't exactly, you know, laughing happily about where globalization has brought them right now. So, you know, just because youth intuitively appreciate this, it doesn't mean that they're all going to be in a good place as a result of it. The acceleration of pressure on every individual to find your niche in the global economy in order to succeed is incredibly intense. And you live in Korea, a place where that's obviously very, very true. But Korea, Switzerland, Singapore, and if in Germany and a few other countries have the kind of policies of what I call, you know, sort of economic master planning that really try to anticipate what the country's niche is going to be in the world economy, and to you know, sort of start to shape labor markets around it, and most importantly, to structure education policies and institutions around it. So to reverse engineer the opportunities, programs, and curricula for young people so that they are not caught sort of out in the cold by the changing economy.
Interesting.
And a lot of countries don't do that. So we are absolutely in a phase where, you know, there's going to be a very rapid distinction or sorting out of winners and losers, you know, perhaps even faster than before. You know, and it's this combination of thinking about education, industrial policy, and so forth that is going to make the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. Well, one question I wanted to ask out of interest at the end was, do you take the view that things are inherently moving towards like more peace, and that we are more peaceful than we have been in the past? Or, you know, there are arguments that we've become less violent, that we're becoming better, and there's this kind of like growth to goodness perspective that's happening. Would you agree with that view, or do you kind of take issue with that view?
Yeah, I mean, it's become a popular viewpoint. But again, I think, you know, everyone finds data to support their point of view, but I think that's a pretty mistaken approach to the world. You know, it looks at the incidence of international conflict, cross-border warfare, A, at a time when there's been a lull in international conflict, and as a result, you're picking a time period that skews your data. B, it ignores the fact that the last, you know, 10, 15 years has been characterized by grotesque civil wars and genocides. And C, it ignores the fact that, you know, I mean, global spending on weapons has gone through the roof, and all of this is likely to blow up at some point, you know, somewhere.
Right.
And so books and theories like that are destined to, you know, sort of head for the rubbish bin pretty fast.
And would you also say, like, just even, you know, the buyouts of economies, I mean, things that are happening that might not be as explicitly violent, but are, you know, destroying economies and destroying countries in other ways?
Exactly, you know, and it doesn't take into account, you know, displacement of people through, you know, I mentioned, you know, refugee issues. But according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, there are more environmental refugees in the world today than political refugees. So people who are displaced by drought, desertification, cyclones, you know, things related to global warming and rising sea level and so forth. So there's that. Then there's traditional things like slavery. I mean, you know, we have a growing body of research and organizations that try to account for and track global slavery. And one of my best friends in the whole world, Ben Skinner, wrote this great book called A Crime So Monstrous. And, you know, the definitive claim there, you know, based on exhaustive research, is that there are more people living in slavery and bonded servitude today, indentured servitude, than at any time in human history.
Yeah.
You know, even sort of accounting for population size. So there's horrific tragedies out there all the time. Yeah. To be using this incredibly narrow data set that says, well, you know, Argentina has gone to war with Brazil, you know, the last couple of decades, or you know, Germany, you know, and Russia haven't gone to war, and China and Japan haven't gone to war recently. That's a pretty narrow way of looking at the world and the way in which humans and societies and collectives interact and do directly or indirectly a lot of violence to each other.
I absolutely agree, yeah. So do you come out of it all an optimist or a pessimist or somewhere in between?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the very last line of that book was Church quoting Churchill saying, I'm an optimist, I don't see a point in being much else. But, you know, it's not his idea. I'm a big fan of the historian Oral Toynbee, who wrote great history of all previous human civilizations. And he used to believe in what he called civilization with a big C. And that's the idea that we don't just have the rise and decline of individual small C civilizations. We also have this arc or wheel of progress, which is the big C civilization. And that each cycle or turn of macro history of, you know, whether it's the world wars or otherwise, we actually learn things. We actually have this process of social, you know, evolution. And in my next book, I'm kind of calling this the global network civilization. Hmm. And it's, you know, as a unit unto itself, something that obviously has not previously existed before. And it kind of fits into this literature around the kind of idea of a global brain, global psychology, you know, kind of a collective non-zero sum or positive sum teleology to the world. And so I like to believe that we have the capacity for that. So in that sense, you know, I suppose I'm more optimistic than pessimistic.
Cool. Well, it's been really fun talking with you. And if people want to learn more, they can also go to your website. And I just wish you all the best. I'll be following your work and looking forward to your next book. So yeah, thanks for coming on. We wish you all the best.
Thanks. I had a great time talking to you.
Okay, take care.